welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to two graduate students. We have with us Rachel Korchinski, who is working on her PhD in chemistry under the supervision of Dr. Philip Jessup and Dr. Michael Cunningham, and Prama Roy, who is working on her PhD in environmental studies under the supervision of Dr. Alison Rutter from Queen's and Dr. Barbara Zeeb, who's a faculty member at the Royal Military College of Canada in the Department of Chemistry. Welcome to Grad Chat, Rachel and Prama.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
Hi, I'm Prama. Thank you for having us.
So Rachel and Prama both conduct exciting research on their dissertations, but today we're going to speak to them in their capacity as the Youth Public Outreach and Education Coordinators for CEC-REN, which is the Contaminants of Emerging Concern Research Excellence Network. So to start off, can you both tell us a little bit about the Contaminants of Emerging Concern Research Excellence Network? What is it, and what do your roles entail?
Sure thing. So as a summary, CEC-REN at Queen's University, so it's based here in Kingston. It's an interdisciplinary research and innovation initiative. It focuses on detection and treatment of emerging contaminants in natural as well as built environments in our ecosystems that pose environmental and human health risk. So CEC-REN is funded by the Ontario Research Fund, the ORF, so we're greatly appreciative for that, as well as other types of collaborations that we have in our particular group as well. But as for what Prama and I do as Youth Public Outreach and Education Coordinators is primarily connecting with, the community and youth to instill that passion of environmental stewardship for not just our current generations, but for generations to come.
Absolutely. So Rachel hit most of the points there. And in particular, our network focuses on detection in water, so contaminants in water for the safety of drinking water in Ontario.
Yeah. And we're led by our phenomenal co-principal investigators, which is one of my supervisors, Dr. Philip Jessup, but also Dr. Pascal Champagne. So without them and their support, a lot of our initiatives would not be possible. So we're really quite appreciative, especially to our team, and as well as working with another individual, Shari. She's fantastic. And while we're the Youth Public and Outreach Education Coordinators, we'd like to say a big thank you to all of our volunteers at CEC-REN, part of our team. So Kristen Hoskin, Ember Carrera, Megan Boyd, Mona Harb, and Rhiannon Punch.
We wouldn't be able to do what we do without their assistance and their passion as well. It makes it a lot more enjoyable having a friendly group of grad students. All of us are grad students to help facilitate our outreach initiatives and making sure we're able to do what we love to do. It's great to have this network for youth outreach.
And they always come with phenomenal ideas.
Absolutely.
Well, that sounds very important and exciting. I guess, can you tell us a little bit more in depth about why it is so important to care about the environment and our water? I mean, we know these kind of big ideas, but can you tell us why we should really, and why our youth should be so concerned about water and care?
Absolutely. So we live on this planet, but we want to make sure our planet stays, you know, as long as it can. I think as individuals and as a society as a whole, we are obligated to protect the resources that we have, the natural world, including the water, but also the soil, sediment, the atmosphere, and they're all interconnected. So when we contaminate water, we're not just contaminating the water itself, but other ecosystems, they're all connected together. So as citizens, and it's sort of our obligation, and even not just citizens, anybody in the world, to make sure that we live in a safe place for us, as well as wildlife out there, and to make sure that we protect our world for generations to come. And as different communities in the world are disproportionately affected by contamination, it's our responsibility for those who have the ability to get out there and participate to really do so to help protect our environment.
And you mentioned, you know, contamination happens, and it happens in different places, but can you explain for myself and for our listeners, what is a contaminant of emerging concern, and how can these seemingly tiny things that we can't necessarily appreciate with the naked eye, how can they and how are they still polluting our water systems?
Yeah, definitely. So a contaminant of emerging concern is an unmonitored and unregulated compound. And sadly, there are quite a few. There's a study that was done in U.S. drinking water where over 300 different types of contaminants were detected, and 90 of those were actually regulated and monitored.
Wow.
So it's pretty profound, especially when research shows that these contaminants adversely impact the health of not just individuals and different ecosystems, but, you know, us as well, right? So it becomes full circle. And that's where the care and important comes in, because you can have a contaminant, but if that contaminant doesn't actually contribute negatively to health impacts, then why do we care, right? So that's the component, is the caring aspect. And the health impacts can be, you know, from endocrine disruption to carcinogenic effects, so cancer-causing compounds. PFAS is a really well and widely known one. So we have our nonstick pans, and now we see the PFAS-free advertisement on a lot of those pans now. So that's generally speaking what an emerging contaminant is and why we care about them.
And how do you test for these contaminants? Like, how can we tell if our water is safe or if it's clean? And especially drinking water, how do we tell if drinking water is safe? I know we have public units, but it sounds like not all of these contaminants are regulated, like you said. So how do we make sure things are still safe?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So the thing is in our environment, a lot of contaminants are at a part per trillion level. So they're very dilute. And this can be difficult to detect. So part of our Research Excellence Network, actually, which is on the research side, there's a group that particularly focuses on improving detection materials and as well as machines for that. In terms of detecting currently right now, you noted it a little bit already, it's not really monitored or regulated. So different contaminants have different methods for detection. And if it's not regulated or monitored, that's not going to be something emphasized, which is something that we're hoping to change. And hopefully we can see that change more in policy as there's more care, then this can be implemented, some of the research into industry. But that does take time. So right now it's more spreading awareness and care about what can we do as a community, as a society, on a first response standpoint, which is, as an example, back in the day, I remember, you know, I'd see maybe my grandparents, like, oh, this medication's expired, I'm going to toss this down the toilet, you know? And you didn't really, I didn't think about it too much as a kid. And after, you know, researching and learning a little bit more, that's not a really good thing. So as an example, what we can do in society is avoid contamination touch points in our society. So don't put expired medication down the toilet. Bring them to the pharmacy for the pharmacist to dispose of accordingly. And that will assist with reducing the exposure in the environment, reducing the exposure to humans, and even assisting in reducing, say, antimicrobial resistance to particular medications that, say, were prescribed by doctors, say, for strep throat or something like that. So it's the detection component can be difficult, but if we know that introducing these into our environment is not really a good thing, then that's a good place for us to start while scientists and policy changes to address detection and address the methods and implementation of different methods for removing these in industry.
Yes, and I think that that kind of anecdotal story, right, of folks flushing things down the toilet, that, you know, that's, I guess, an education change, right? Like, that's a practice that people have to get used to doing, but in a really effective way that doesn't necessarily take anything new in terms of equipment or technology, but a change in behavior, which can be challenging to get people to adopt. So it sounds like this initiative is one of many that can help make an impact. So you started to touch on a little bit about the impact of science on policy, but why do scientists study what's in our water and environment more broadly? I think we've touched on that a little bit, but why? What are some of the reasons that you think scientists study water and environment?
Absolutely. Well, if you care about your health, like we should all do, you study what's in your water and what you drink and consume, and what you also put into the water as well, because we don't just consume water. We release water through mm-hmm. through pipes, and then we affect other organisms in the environment as well. So Rachel touched on the detection and how there's no one size fits all method. So different contaminants, there's mm-hmm. different methods of detection. Mm-hmm. For example, antibiotic resistance genes, they often monitor wastewater for that. Microplastics, they might use microscopy techniques, and they're trying to improve upon those mm-hmm. Techniques because they are, like, emerging contaminants are so hard to detect. So it's important for us because of all the different health effects it has upon us, as well as across the food chain. So if you contaminate, you know, your water and it reaches, for example, fish, and then the fish waste reaches, like, the plants, say, in, like, a hydroponic system, mm-hmm. and then different organisms consume different organisms for sustenance, and mm-hmm. then you get sort of this trend, potentially, of biomagnification, which is kind of a complex term, but it shows that when you consume a certain amount of, like, a certain contaminant, it can amplify in the food chain, so it can have even more increasing toxic mm-hmm. effects through this food web. So that's why we should care about it, and why we should do all this testing. And for our roles as the youth public and outreach education coordinators, we're really trying to instill citizen science within the youth mm-hmm. so that, you know, maybe they don't understand the complexity of this science that they do in the lab at that level yet, but maybe they'll be passionate about it, and that they can also participate by helping reduce the amount of pollution they contribute to, but also being passionate about it and educating their family, friends, peers, guardians, so that this knowledge can be spread throughout society as well.
Exactly. So empowering the youth to be environmental stewards and mm-hmm. providing them the knowledge to instill that care in anyone and everyone that is around them. And that's something that we also note on when we go and we present to schools, is not just simply what we care about, the contaminants mm-hmm. in the water, but we also make sure to highlight different career pathways that one could actually pursue, maybe in the sciences, all the way from engineering to administration, and the importance of all of them and how they interconnect with one another.
So it sounds like both in your approach to science, which is very holistic and thinking, you know, from consumption to maybe something entering into a food system and then back being consumed again by humans, all the way to approaching youth and thinking about their behavior, but also their potential careers and potential impact, right? So you're thinking both about the science and about your outreach in really long-term ways, which I think is great, right? You're just, like I said, like, just like with your science, you're not looking at one little piece of it. And with your youth outreach, you're not looking at one little piece. You're trying to help youth make the connection about how important it is for them to understand contaminants of emerging concern in their lives and all the different ways it touches, and maybe all the ways that they could help fix it in the future themselves as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And also noting that some contaminants we actually need. So soap, mm-hmm. that's a contaminant.
Yeah.
But, you know, we do care about our hygiene. So we explain too that us as humans, we have introduced certain phenomenal materials that are really quite useful for us, like soap. And while it's a contaminant, we need to use that. And so regardless, it will go down the sink, in the sewers, into our environment. But it's understanding that while we might be putting something into a system that helps us but can have negative consequences, the understanding and the foresight of, okay, well, then we need to care about how to remove this before it goes into the environment. And just understanding the holistic view and sense of science and care for the world around us.
Soap is a very, very common, common one. But what are, like, some other common things that come to mind that people pour down the drain? Things like paint or medicine, shampoos, those types of things. What happens to other types of everyday products or household products? What happens when those go down the sink or down the drain?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. Prama noted a few of, I think, more of the unpopular ones, like the medicine, antimicrobial resistant. Mm-hmm. Those are super important. You mentioned paint, which is funny because that is true. And, you know, if you're doing, like, water-based painting at mm-hmm. home, that's going to go down your sink. Soap, definitely one. Antibiotics, we touched on. But yeah, when those go down into your sinks, it'll go through the wastewater treatment plants and water treatment plants. And while they're really good at removing a lot of contaminants that they're built and designed to remove, mm-hmm. they can't remove most of these other types of contaminants. So say a type of pharmaceutical, they're just not designed for that. And mm-hmm. there's no one size fits all approach for removing all the contaminants in the world. So that's something that's important. And when these contaminants do kind of sneak through the system, they end up in our environment where certain studies in certain parts of the world, they've seen sex changes in frogs, for example, when there's been high amounts of a certain particular pharmaceutical that was detected in that particular water environment or aqueous system. So there's different effects that can occur by these contaminants getting through, some worse than others. But that's just an example of one and a resulting, sadly, very negative side effect.
It makes me think, and this is a bit of an aside, but for anyone who, I guess, is like a millennial like me, some of the popular skincare products that were marketed towards folks when I was growing up were all about exfoliation with what they called microbeads, which we now know are just microplastics. So thinking about how common some of those daily products were for, you know, washing your face, and they were marketed towards teens. And I think those are, I don't think they're popular anymore, but, you know, for a decade, those were the hot product that everyone was using to wash their face on a daily basis. And were our public water treatment centers able to capture that? Were they even aware? Who knows? So so I think a lot of people will be able to relate to the different things that you are investigating. And I'm curious, what's it, because it sounds like you both are working with water a lot, both in your own research but also with your outreach work. What is the most surprising or unusual thing that you've ever found in water?
That's a really good question. So I actually work with soil contaminants. So you can find little, because water and soil, they're connected through the environment, often through like groundwater, which is below the layer of soil. So you can find all sorts of contaminants. I work with petroleum in general. So petroleum hydrocarbons. So these, they form like emulsions that can be hard to actually remove from soil. And it's surprising, though, because in terms of petroleum contamination, we have legislation in place for industry to not contaminate the environment, or that they have to be responsible for remediating or getting rid of those contaminants. However, this before the Canadian Environmental Protection Act, there's so many what we call legacy polluted sites. So these are sites that have been polluted prior to the year 1999, which is when CEPA was passed. So we see all sorts of petroleum-based contaminants, and I found it surprising that you can get, like, metals mixed in with petroleum, which was not something I knew about before I started my program, but a lot of the refinery processes for petroleum involves extracting these metals, but also, like, observing how they're co-contaminants. In a sense, that's even more concerning, because two or more different contaminants together within a mixture can have compounding health effects upon different organisms in the environment as well. And it can transport to water through groundwater transport as well. But soil is a little bit difficult to remediate, because you don't have it dispersing as much. So in that sense, it's concentrated a little bit more in a certain region. But at the same time, you don't have to worry about it spreading to other ecosystems quite that at that level unless it rains. So there's a different dynamic involved depending on what type of environmental matrix you're working with, but Rachel does work with water directly.
I do work with water, but I work with like synthetic versions of water, so I make my own contaminated water to mimic some things. But all in all, there's a wide array of things that you would find in water that you otherwise would ponder to yourself, interesting. And really, it is emphasized by a lot of the things that we've noted. But one of the really interesting components is actually viruses and stuff like that that we actually get sick with. And that you can, when we go to the bathroom, it's excreted out. And that method was used actually for monitoring COVID in different populations, as an example. So a lot of people don't really think about that component or side of things, and how you can actually use wastewater in a way that can be positive by detecting and monitoring what particularly is in those water systems. So I'd say that for me was pretty interesting on a health standpoint.
It's very interesting, and it does bring up memories of news stories, you know, following different municipalities and their reports of what was showing up in their wastewater back in a few years ago when we were more focused on COVID-19. And I'd be curious to know, hopefully some of those programs have stayed up, but are, you know, can be used to look at other trends like annual flu or something like that, not just when we have a pandemic on our hands, but, you know, maybe it's helpful to see just a general snapshot of a municipality's health through water. So that's very interesting. And I'm curious to know more about what your outreach kind of days look like, because you're working with lots of youth and children and you're explaining the importance of keeping water clean and you're explaining, you know, how our day-to-day actions can have a positive or negative impact, but, you know, hopefully a positive impact for the youth who work with you after their session. But how do you convey this to them? Like, are there some experiments or demonstrations that you use? And yeah, how do you explain this to them through demonstration or get them excited about this? A little bit of an abstract concept maybe for children, but how do you make it concrete for them?
Yeah, so that's dependent upon the age group. So obviously we'll tailor different subjects in different ways to different age groups to make sure that, you know, we're not confusing anybody or boring anybody, but keeping it interesting. So as an example, for the younger grades, instead of saying contaminants in your water, we'll say, do you want to learn about yucky stuff in your water?
Yes.
You know? we'll substitute the word contaminant for something a little bit more fun. So how we convey the information is primarily really important. So we make sure to always brainstorm on that front. We also make sure to involve DIY, do-it-yourself types of experiments and make sure that those are age-appropriate as well. So we use one experiment that we use celery, and in other words, you kind of just stick it in some dyed water, and over time it will suck up the dye into its leaves. And that we can show and demonstrate, hey, this is how your environment, a plant as an example, could be taking up a contaminant. Even though the world around us looks great and healthy, this is an example of how dye can actually go into and how it's interacting with our ecosystem. And then as we go through into the higher grades, we'll do some more interactive types of DIY activities. So we'll do filtration activities. They'll get to put all of it together themselves, and they get so excited and learning. They're like, oh, the dye isn't working the way it should. And we're like, but that's where you learn. Okay, let's brainstorm what might have went awry. And they're like, oh, we think this, so we'll give them more material, and they'll try their hypothesis out, and it works, and they get so happy. It's really quite rewarding to see when the light bulb's gone on and there's actual passion. We also use a series of different, like, YouTube videos that can really portray the information in an interesting fashion that uses diagrams and cartoons. So we really try and use a wide array of different types of learning materials to really make sure that we're being as inclusive as possible as well.
Oh, that sounds great. So a variety of things, and, you know, thinking about resources as well. Celery is a pretty cheap resource to use, but gives, you know, maybe an elementary school student a real world tangible example right away about what you're talking about the yucky water. So
yeah.
And how can kids help keep our water clean at home or school? Like, what should they be doing, and what do you talk to them about in your presentations about how their actions can make a positive impact?
So one key element through all of our age group presentations is we tell the children and youth to not flush expired or unused medicine down the sink or down the toilet, to actually they can bring it back to the pharmacy in Canada. In the US they have medicine take back programs, so it depends on where, but essentially we don't want to promote antibiotic resistance genes or other viruses from becoming immune to the medicine by putting it down our drains. So we tell them this, and we tell them, you know, tell your friends and family, spread this awareness. And it is really important as well through an outreach perspective, because it helps keep the youth engaged that they are part of the solution. That even, you know, they might be young and they might be something that they're just learning about, but they have a role that they can play, and that keeps them inspired as well, and hopefully encourages them to consider pursuing a career in environmental protection down the line. And it's not going to be the case for everybody, but, you know, it's still some sort of passion. and engagement with them as well.
So what's your favorite part of visiting schools and doing science outreach? And I think we kind of talked about this a little bit, but how do you make science fun for students?
One of the reasons I love visiting schools is I love seeing youth, and it just kind of brings back memories from when I was their age, and knowing that I can go back to a similar environment to where I was when I was younger, going through elementary school, middle school, high school, and inspiring that sort of passion and the way their eyes light up sometimes when you introduce a concept with them that really connects to their daily lives or just that they didn't know, and they're like, whoa, that's, I didn't know that. That, you know, makes me feel good. It's a job that really makes you feel good inside. You feel fulfilled, and especially as a grad student, you're in the lab many days or you're writing. It kind of brings an element that there's more to life than just that. I mean, it is a very important part of our life and a very large part of our day-to-day, but there's other ways you can participate through the community, and this is one of the ways I wanted to get involved in.
Yeah. To add on, what I really quite enjoyed, and it reminded me of this on what Prama said, is that, you know, we're in the lab, we're doing writing a lot. We talk technical talk all of the time, where it's really important to be able to express importance outside of just a little bubble of individuals that know, say, the nitty-gritty details. That's how you instill change and passion. And what's really critically important is learning and setting almost a foundation up in order to connect research and bridge research understanding to community understanding, which is a lot of the time a gap that is missing. So I believe for me, that's something that I quite find fulfilling and enjoyable. And when people go, okay, I understand what you're saying, that makes me smile, makes them smile, everybody's smiling, everybody's now caring. So when we're able to do that, we're able to instill the passion for the next generation. And that's so critical, because while there's a bunch of individuals right now in respective fields doing wonderful work, what's going to happen when they move on or when they retire? Who's going to come in and have that same passion, not just simply do it because, oh, it's a job and it pays at the end of the day? Because truly, you need the passion, you need that component, the care, to really drive innovation.
Well, it sounds very rewarding.
And I think our job also helps make science very accessible to people. Like, not everyone's going to be able to read a scientific article and understand the jargon or the terminology there. But making it accessible to everybody in the community and for them to get inspired, it's an amazing feeling inside. And it also helps bring different members of communities through their different respective fields together. And when we highlight the different career options that youth can take in our presentations, we highlight that, you know, there's administration that brings all of these different careers like engineering, biology, chemistry, policy, and law together. And as a society, that's what we are. We are together in this for a better change in our future.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's so phenomenal and important to emphasize, because I notice even a lot of disciplines don't really emphasize that, or being aware of how they communicate their thoughts or what they're trying to convey to an individual outside of their field. That people don't really actively think about that, which I think is so critically important. And so we highlight that a lot.
Yeah, it's hard, right, if you get speaking in your own little disciplinary silo, to forget that how highly specialized the research that you both do, and other graduate students and postdocs and faculty members, that highly specialized research that, you know, someone who might hold a PhD in a different area might not even understand what you're talking about because it's so, so niche. So it's great that you're able to work together across disciplines and share really exciting early research and new knowledge with kids, like little ones, all the way up to youth, and get them excited about the possibilities and kind of translate both the research but translate the possibilities to them as well. That sounds very exciting. And I wanted to ask, because it sounds like a lot of fun times and when you're visiting these classrooms or these different settings, but have you ever seen a student get really excited about your science? And can you kind of set the stage for us and let us know what happened?
I particularly really enjoy presenting to the youngest age group for us. It's like the 5 to 8 year olds. So we visited the YMCA of Eastern Ontario, so on Wright Crescent, as well as their LCVI location. And what's great about the youngest youth is they're not afraid to go up to their screen and point at things that interest them. They sometimes even cut you off. But we are happy for those interruptions. And they'll talk about, my friend mentioned this. I learned this. And we love that. They're connecting it in their minds to their daily lives, what they've learned before. They're very hands-on. So one of our visits, we were talking about dyes being a contaminant in water, and they were making, I think, slime. And we were like, hey, you can see there's dye in your slime, and you don't want that in your water. That can hurt you and can hurt, like, the fish in the ocean. So making those connections and seeing the light bulb go off in their brain is really great to see. Of course, we love presenting to the older age groups and getting them thinking about, they're going to be thinking a little bit more about their career down the line. And as scientists, we can kind of connect through our research a little bit more on that front as well. But there's different elements to different age groups that we connect well with, and kind of have to find which one works for each age group.
Exactly, yeah. Pramo gave an awesome example. Yeah, the younger age groups, they're so involved. It's fantastic. And then the older age groups are as well. Mm. They ask really, really critical questions. They really think about the outcomes. You know, one question was, oh, so what happens to the pharmaceuticals when you give them back to the pharmacist? Mm. Like, they're actively listening and thinking, and it's phenomenal. And then we'll even have some students that really, truly are inspired come up to us even after the presentation, go, this was great. I learned so much. Can I ask you some more questions? Mm. And we're staying there and we're like, great. And they're willing to stand there and ask questions, you know, during their lunch hour. They're that interested, which is, you know, phenomenal. So, you know, when you reach the students that really, truly do care and you instill that passion and the wonder, it's quite rewarding. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing like having the excitement of a six-year-old to justify the importance of your work as you're going through. And you know they're going to remember that, right? Like they, yeah.
Actually, that reminds me of a really funny story. So we were volunteering at a science rendezvous because we go to a bunch of schools in the Kingston community. Mm. We were just at REGI recently, a phenomenal group of lead teachers and students, and then also YMCA. But we've also been to science rendezvous twice here in Kingston. And I remember I was teaching this parent group with their kids about dyes and contaminants in water, and you know, let's make sure that we throw pharmaceuticals not in the toilet but to the pharmacy. And this little kid just looked at their parent and went, you do that, don't do that. And the parent just you know, chuckled a little bit, but I was like, ah, yes, this is what we want. So that I gotta say was probably kind of came out of nowhere, but it was like, okay, the lesson was definitely learned, and they became an environmental steward at the age of 5, which was quite nice to see.
Yes, there's nothing like accountability from your kindergartner to keep you honest about where you're taking your leftover pharmaceuticals.
Yep.
Oh, well, Prama and Rachel, it has been great chatting with you. Thank you both for coming on the show and telling us about your fantastic work with youth in the community via the Contaminants of Emerging Concern Research Excellence Network. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.